Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and here was the reaction on one Delta Airlines flight when the news came down.
The Biden administration announced that the Transportation Security Administration will no longer enforce the federal mandate requiring masks in all U.S. airports and on board aircraft.
Finally!
Effective immediately, masks are optional for all airport employees, crew members, and customers inside U.S. airports and on board aircraft.
All right. The federal mask mandate has come to an end, it would seem. TSA won't enforce it. We'll see if the Biden administration appeals that Florida district court judge's injunction. Seems doubtful with just the two-week extension. We're halfway to it. So finally, you can fly mask-free. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636-DA. Turnkey.pro text line.
And I got to tell you, Peyton was coming back last night from New Orleans, and he was the, I go, listen, you are part of history. You get to be mask-free. And he said, no one wore a mask. Everyone was so happy. One Delta flight attendant that Justin just showed me a video of her, she was actually crying because it's been hard for them, you know, for the past 2 years, telling people to, you know, mask up. And another flight attendant on JetBlue, we believe, sang a song. And he was holding a bag.
Composition.
Literally, he was literally holding a garbage bag and walking down the aisle and having people throw away their masks. Because this has been, I mean, I don't know. I was at I was at Dallas, Vegas this past whole week at different airports. And, you know, half the people don't want to wear them anyway. And then when you got on the plane, it depended on the flight attendant whether or not they were going to enforce it. I mean, I ran from D4 to A21 in Dallas, and if anybody's been through Dallas Airport, you know what a boondoggle that is, and I had to make it in 10 minutes, and I get on the plane, I'm completely sweating and just exhausted, and the first thing the flight attendant says to me is, you know what, I don't like your mask, you're going to have to put this one on or get off the plane, and she so enjoyed it, just, you know, having that power and the control, but guess what, this morning that power and control is gone, and it's back to the people.
Yeah. I got to say, you know, ending this a week early, finally, at the hands of an injunction from a federal district court judge leaves me a little wanting. I can't muster the enthusiasm that some have because of what we've experienced. And then the impetus for many will be to just put what's happened over the last 2 years in the rearview mirror and pretend like it didn't happen. And that's not good enough. The judge in the case ruling that the CDC exceeded its statutory authority never clearly explained its justification for the mask mandate. And it's based on a careful reading of the Public Health Service Act of 1944, which was also the basis of striking down the vax mandate promulgated by the Biden administration. It's nice that we have a few judges actually looking at statutory law that's being invoked for or that was invoked for these federal mandates and the bastardization of that statutory language by the COVIDians. But I don't know. Yeah, I'm glad the mask mandate is gone, just like I'd be glad mask mandates are gone just generally. We should have never done it in the first place, it turns out. But is that what people's takeaway is? We should have never done it in the first place, that it was completely ineffectual, that it was... A to generate a false sense of security, to be a dutiful sentinel of the state. Is that what the takeaway is? Or it's, you know, we're finally on the other side of COVID. We can take the masks off. We can live again. And I'm not really mad at anybody for what they did over the last 2 years, because we just didn't know enough, and out of an abundance of caution, this was the prudent course of action.
312-642-5600. Excuse me. Turnkey Debt Pro answer line 64636. Type in DA. Then a quick comment. Well, here in Chicago, you still have to wear masks on CTA and Metro. But who's really going to be enforcing that? And then, you know, every reporter in the world went to O'Hare Airport to talk to the passengers and what they're going to do.
I'm a little bit dumbfounded by it, because I still think there's plenty to be caught on airplanes.
Yeah. I mean, it's psychosis.
I don't think it's too premature, but I'll hold off for my own personal.
You're still going to wear yours?
For a little while longer, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, this is sort of my point, is what's people's understanding of what has transpired over the last 2 years, not just what happened yesterday. Good piece from our friend John Tierney over at City Journal on this topic, talking about the mass culture in other places, too. Difficult addiction to overcome, according to Japanese therapists who specialize in treating it. Very difficult. Mask dependency is an actual term that some psychologists have given to this psychological condition. A long tradition of mask wearing during the flu season has left some individuals afraid at any time to expose their faces in public in Japan. And it seems like we have a bit of that going on in this country as well, in spite of the evidence. By the way, before we get to the Biden administration's response to that Florida district court judge's injunction, just again here, and I just posted this from John Tierney's piece, okay, graphing the impact of mask mandates, comparing and contrasting mask mandate states versus no mask mandate states over the last year and a half. This graphs it from April 30 to essentially February 1. And what do you find? If you add up all the numbers in this graph, which you can obtain at City Journal or from my Twitter feed, John Tierney writes, you find the mask mandates made zero difference.
Mm-hmm.
The cumulative rate of infection over the course of the pandemic was about 24% in the mandate states as well as in the non-mandate states. Their cumulative rates of COVID mortality were virtually identical, too. In fact, there were slightly more deaths per capita in the states with mask mandates.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots more data for all of you erstwhile, or and your friends, erstwhile men and women of data and science, in a book by Ian Miller, who's a data analyst for a City Journal. He tracked pandemic trends for the Brownstone Institute. He produced a report called Unmask, the Global Failure of COVID Mask Mandates. So, you know, if we don't understand what the impact was, then we can't make a determination on the policy choices that were made. Then we can learn no lessons from what we did to ourselves over the last 2 years. So, you know, I hate to be the party pooper here with the news of, you know, going mask free on airplanes. And that is good. But let's also take this opportunity to share the information I'm sharing. Here's how it went at the White House briefing, where that stupid SOB, Peter Ducey,
yes,
had the gall to ask one of those common sense questions.
Disappointing decision, and you say you continue to recommend that people wear masks. Why is it that we can sit here in the White House briefing room with no masks, but people can't sit in an airplane cabin with no masks?
Well, Peter, I'm not a doctor. You're not a doctor. That I'm aware of. If you're a doctor, I wasn't aware of that today, until today.
Right.
Okay, not a doctor.
Oh, what a great sense of humor.
And
nor do you play one on TV.
Nor does he play one on TV. There you go. Most days. But these determinations, remember, the masking guidance is is green, yellow, and red. We are currently in a green zone in Washington, D.C., so they're not recommending it. Some people can still wear a mask if they want to. Many people people do, or wear them in meetings, or wear them at certain times where you're going to be around or sitting close to people, or maybe you have an immunocompromised parent or friend, and so people make that decision. And this is based on health considerations and data that the CDC looks at about transmissibility, as we've seen an increase in cases on airplanes.
And would the president support if a flight is leaving from an airport in a green zone, those people don't have to wear masks?
Again, Peter, there's been a difference from the beginning about people on an airplane and in federal transportation vehicles and situations than where they are in locations. Like we here continue to be in Washington, D.C., a green zone. But what we'd ask for, I think it's important to remember, is a 2-week extension, or not ask for, what we had announced was a 2-week extension to look at the data and make recommendations based on the data and the science about whether it should be continued or not.
Okay. When you sit next to somebody still wearing a mask on a plane next time, which will happen.
Oh, it's going to happen for the rest of our lives.
Ask them, hey, do you know, are we in a green, yellow, or red zone? And could you, could you help me? I'm not sure I know the difference between green, yellow, and red.
Oh, you've never known the difference.
Could you explain that to me? and then the thinking that goes behind your mask wearing. So when do you think, in your opinion, as an expert, as a scientist, as somebody who follows the data, when do you think I should wear the mask? And give me that green, red, yellow protocol. Is there some place I can get this? Where do you go to daily to consult whether you're in a green, yellow, or red zone?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer. Dan, our guy Arnie Duncan weighed in on this. He tweeted out yesterday, for my safety and for the safety of my family, friends, and everyone I come in contact with, please keep wearing a mask when you travel. I promise to do the same. Thank you for helping to save lives. So that's what the left thinks, that they're still, these superheroes, COVID heroes that are going to, mask up and save people from themselves.
That's what they want you to think, because they have to defend what they did.
Yeah, but he's the same.
They have to fool you, and Obama's personal rebounder is just a functionary of the left. He is just a talking points repeater of the left.
Yeah, but remember, he likened Americans who want mask and vax choice to suicide bombers in Kabul. Remember that tweet?
I know. That's what I said. He is a man of the left. I mean, in terms of being an automaton. You consider him a man of the left. He's not a thought leader. He's just somebody that repeats whatever hysterics are coming from the blue-checked thought leaders of the left. They have to convince you that you saved lives, because how else to defend what they've done for the last 2 years and what they want you to continue to do?
As we've always said.
Not to mention, you're the hero in the story. Arnie Duncan's the hero in the story.
Pritzker's
you who follow
hero.
Arnie Duncan is the hero in the story. Arnie Duncan, who follows the leftist thought leaders, the COVIDian high priestesses, they're the heroes in the story. They save lives. That's their story, and they're sticking to it.
And they'll never listen to any science and data that says otherwise, because it's hard to convince people that they have been fooled for 2 years.
Terry Rogers Park.
What about hospitals and doctor offices? Their mask mandates annoy me more than anything.
That's right.
That's never going to go away.
That's a state and local issue. Thanks for the call, Terry.
And what about isolating kids still in quarantine?
You're in the wrong state and locality. State and local issue. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan, Amy, and thanks for taking my call. Dan, you are exactly right about how this thing is going down, and that it's a good that they did this with the airline, but who the heck's going to take on these damn school unions and stuff like that, where our kids, they got all kinds of still things with the kids, with requirements and all that, and it's only a matter of a little bit of time these leftists are going to come roaring back with something on this thing.
Thanks for the call, Craig.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I feel a duty bound to address Adam Kinzinger's Fare Thee Well letter in the form of a Wall Street Journal op-ed. But before we do that, Jesse in Hammond, Indiana, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
How's it going, Dan and Amy?
Good. Hello.
Yeah, this is Jesse. Yep. I'm an Uber driver in Chicago, and every time I pick up riders, I tell them, hey, I show them the mask in my hand. You guys want to wear it or not? And they're like, no. I said, well, take it off. You know, mainly in the airports, they're just like, they're relieved to take that damn thing off.
Yeah.
You know, because they've had it on for 4 or 5 or 6 hours all day. So, I mean, I don't care too much for that mask. But some of the seniors and people with compromised immune systems or so, I let them wear it. I don't say anything, you know, but
right.
98% of my riders are like, I don't want to wear this thing. You know?
Yeah. Well, and Uber announced, Uber announced that they're not, it's a mask optional. And we're still waiting to hear from Lyft. So I don't know if you've gotten that.
Yeah. No, well, I just woke up right now, but I'll probably get it on the app. But since July of last year, I've been telling my riders, you don't got to wear that crap. So, I mean, I tell them I'm from Indiana. We don't have this thing, you know.
Yeah, well, the corporate titans, just like the government bureaucrats, are the last to know, aren't they? Thanks for the call,
Jesse.
Yeah, but
I didn't wear a mask one time on Uber, and then they banned me from Uber unless I took a picture of me wearing a mask getting ready to be picked up. And so then I switched to Lyft.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's how draconian these measures were.
Well, those are the sorts of things that have happened over the last 2 years that should be indelibly etched into your brain, the collective you. We should not forget all of these instances of cruelty masked, pun intended, by terrible public policy.
When all those children and those families that were kicked off planes because they're 2-year-old and 3-year-olds, because moms and dads struggled to mask their children. I mean, shame on those people that did that to them, because there's some flight attendants that were cool, because I've watched this over the past 2 years, and then there's some that were just, they loved that position of power.
Well, here again, this is the, you know, I don't have to have a brain because we have policies and procedures. So I'm just going to defer to whatever edict is handed down by my faraway superiors in D.C. And to the extent that they haven't contemplated something, or they haven't contemplated the implementation of something in such a way that it is cruel to a vulnerable person, like a child that's autistic or some such thing like this, the examples we've given. Then I don't worry. I won't try to problem solve. I won't try to be a human being because I have these rules. So I'm just following orders. I'm just following the rules. I have these policies and procedures. You have this in life in general. This is part of American culture now. You have this when you deal with various helplines or reservation bookers at hotels. If you want to make an alteration, you experience this all the time. I can't problem solve. I don't have a brain. They told me I didn't need a brain because we've got these policies and procedures. This is the same thing that produces zero tolerance policies at the K-12 level. I don't have a brain. The policies and procedures say if a toddler points his index finger and his thumb in such a way as to mimic a gun, then he has to be expelled.
Right.
I don't have a brain. He's a threat to public safety. It was a terrorist attack. Because I have policies and procedures right here that tell me.
Yeah.
That's what mask wearing was. That's what all this stuff is. Don't think.
Oh,
obey.
But the hypocrisy, too. Like at certain churches, you can't wear masks, but then when the service is over, everyone has drinks and snacks with their masks off.
Adam Kinzinger on his way out.
Yes.
Hey, well, why is it in Illinois that any Illinois politician that gets some national profile, however fleeting, and it is always fleeting, is a embarrassment?
When we figure it out, we'll let you know.
Can you think of an Illinois politician who has attained some national profile in the last 50 years that hasn't been a complete embarrassment?
No. I can't think of one.
I would say Peter Fitzgerald, but I don't know how much really national profile he had. I mean, you have national profile as one of 100 U.S. senators, but I mean, he wasn't really like a a media figure. He wasn't, you know, sort of dominant in these national debates.
Mel Reynolds was an embarrassment. Carol Moseley Braun. I mean, the list goes on and on.
It really does go on and on. And we continue to build it.
Roland Burris, Roly the Boo.
Well, Republicans, too.
Oh, yeah, right. Adam Kinzinger.
Case in point. America is at a crossroads, politically speaking. So am I, writes Kinzinger. The Republican Party I joined decades ago is unrecognizable today. Conspiracy theories over truth, anger over hope, division over problem solving. Oh, gosh.
Do we need to put a dramatic reading with this?
I am left carrying the torch for the values and principles of a party that's been overtaken by partisan politicos looking for the limelight and clinging to their sense of power instead of upholding their oaths of office. Boy. This fails the mirror test, and I'm only in the second paragraph.
Where's the intro? And now a dramatic reading by Dan Proft.
But we need some sort of, like,
include me on this.
We need some over-the-top jingoistic music. We need, like, the sort of the patriotic music, jingoistic, really, that, like, was attendant to, like, a Hacksaw Jim Duggan entering the ring for a world wrestling match.
Okay, we'll get that for you. But it might take a few minutes.
Hulk Hogan. Hacksaw Jim Duggan, maybe too arcane. I am a real American. You know, one of those.
Okay.
I'm a real American. That one. I don't want to cheapen the Lee Greenwood. Uh-huh. It's got to be something that's over the top where you can do your Hulk Hogan, you know, antics in the ring. You know, put your hand to your ear waiting for the crowd of this side to cheer and then go over to the other side. You know, that whole thing.
Right. Yeah, we've seen it.
That's what this is. That's what this op-ed feels like to me. It feels like something Leaping Lanny Poffo might have written before a WWE match or back in that day.
Is there
WWF.
A good part of this?
No, there's no good part to it. There's just Kinzinger's preening, because that's what these cheap demagogues do. He just becomes more and more embarrassing the more he opens his mouth. And he also, very much like these politicians that get all emotional, he's so emotional about everything now. He's really sort of an emotional mess. He's always breaking down into tears about things. Needs to pull it together. But this is really just a predicate for attention to this initiative he's undertaking, which is positively prosaic. Somebody who thinks he's the first guy to ever try to do this little scam that he's trying to run.
Okay.
Shortly after the January 6, 2021 insurrection, at the Capitol.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I started the Country First organization for reasonable people of goodwill who want to bring truth and accountability back to government. In 1 year, it's grown to nearly 150,000 members and 6,000 volunteers. Sure. Americans across the political spectrum are tired of all the vitriol and feel disenfranchised by both parties, yet the outrage machine continues to churn out negativity. This is like a bad Keith Olbermann rant, is what this is.
We're trying to find the right music for you.
And he finally, you know, gets to this point where it's like, you know, I may be leaving Congress, but I'm not done fighting for my country and so on and so forth. So this Country First org that he started, this is a way for, I guess, I don't know who in the middle, probably more on the left, would fund Kinzinger to be an antagonist towards the Republican Party and towards conservatives, which is what he's now become across the range of issues, not just January 6th, not just Trump. He's also voting for big spending. It's funny, once you lose your way, boy, do you lose your way.
Wasn't it's he like part Ronner. Of the Lincoln Project, too?
Well, I mean, this is something different, but I mean, it's sort of the same thing.
Right.
It's the same. It's actually more like the No Labels organization. People don't even remember because it lasted for about 5 minutes, but it got much fanfare when it was introduced. This is back at the end of the Bush era, W era, you know, before we had Obama come in and heal the nation.
Right.
This was like Mark McKinnon, the self-styled, political consultants who think they're actually, you know, sort of philosophers, he's a ridiculous character, and a bunch of other people, Joe Scarborough, You know, that's the right. precursor to Adam Kinzinger. He was a no labels guy. No labels. The parties have both failed and this and that and the vitriol and the division and an outrage machine over truth. And we're truth and they're not truth. So the there was a version of that a decade ago that went nowhere. Why? Because it doesn't have any point. It's just self-indulgence. It's just a bunch of navel gazing from mainly from politicians or political consultants who were quislings within their party, usually the Republican Party, usually the conservative movement, like a Kinzinger, like a McKinnon, like a Scarborough, and like a Walsh. And then they got to find some way to have the moral high ground. So they create these, I'm not part of any party. I'm politically homeless. This party left me and so on and so forth. And they never really, as Kinzinger doesn't do here, they never really articulate any my country first. What does that mean? It means I'm for truth and they're for misinformation. Oh, OK. So what's your truth? What is it you want to accomplish? What the first principles that inform this policy agenda that you're going to pursue are what? We have no idea because they never talk in that way. They talk in the way of I'm saving my country because I'm a patriot. And anyone who disagrees with me is a conspiracy theorist, is a crackpot, is a Russian asset, you know, is part of the outrage machine. Is the worst person in the world, you know, Keith Olbermann style. It's all hyperventilation Barking all the time.
We're all going to die.
Yeah, that's what Kinzinger is now.
I know. Who thought, and you used to be, well, you were with allies. I mean, well, he's been on the show hundreds of times and now.
Well, a lot of times, not about hundreds, but
well,
a lot of times.
Well, before you got here, he was on a lot.
Yeah. Well, no, and he was on when I was here over the last 7 years, too, when he was. During the Obama years, really.
Right.
And then even during Trump, we had him on a couple of times where there were disagreements. But that was before he went, you know, completely off into the wilderness to found Country First and, I don't know, have a communal environment with Jack Dorsey and other people who live in that forest milling about. I don't know. It's just bizarre, though, to watch the complete self-dissembling of a politician who actually had like a, you know, a bit of a record, military service. He wasn't, you know, a complete bipartisan combine toady like so many Republicans in this state. He seemed to have his own mind and then he lost it. I don't know. I don't know really what explains it. Perhaps it's the lure of media and aggrandizement. You start to think you're really an important person, that the republic hinges on you. And I have to do something important here because my friends in the media who will amplify my profile say this is an important moment where I need to step up. And then I start to believe this is an important moment where I step up. And the way that I step up is I say things that aren't true in service of these people that can amplify my profile. And then I just continue to rationalize that by getting more and more patriotic in my own mind, whipping myself more and more into a self-righteous haze, as it were.
But don't you think he realized that, you know, he lost his base in Illinois and then realized, well, I got to get a job. Because I'm not going to be a congressman anymore, so you know I'll lob on to this MSNBC or to CNN to be an analyst to try to, you know, have a future career to feed his family, his newborn.
Yeah,
child.
Or I'll run this little game of, you know, a pox on both your houses. Give me money, and I'll run around saying both parties suck, and I'm the truth and the light, which is essentially what he's doing. Jim in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You know, what you ought to do is put the high school graduation commencement march behind these guys. I had to sit through that speech of a principal five times, and everybody was talking and not paying attention. And every time I hear these politicians speak, I have a flashback to those moments.
Yeah, it's not bad. Band music, because it's like, you know, we're the future kind of, you know, empty-headed speech here to... At a high school graduation, yeah, okay. Frank, Arlington Heights.
Well, maybe Adam Kinzinger could lead a new Abraham Lincoln Brigade over to Ukraine. He might get a job as the chief of staff for Senator Chris Coons. But
right.
On another note, I sent you a good theme song for Adam Kinzinger. It's the opening to the Twin Eagle video game. I don't know if you remember that one. Amy, you might remember it was at Twin Links Golf Course over there in Mount Prospect.
Great
place to go. I used to go over there and just play that game, and the song started out like, and then the music just kept going.
Uh-huh.
To shoot your missiles and everything. I think that's what Adam King sees himself doing.
We'll try to find it, Frank.
We're going to effort that. we got to revisit this and put this to music. I think that's a good idea. All right, we're going to work on that. Thanks for the recommendation, Frank. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's not bad.
That is it.
All right, so we got I'm a Real American. We got Frank from Rockin' Heights' Twin Eagle song. We got a marching band. I think I got a text from 8472, something orchestral that builds to a crescendo. I think the 1812 Overture, I think Tchaikovsky could work on this, but we're going to have to...
text messages on this.
We're going to have to sync up the prose with the... With the music. So that's, that's going to take some work. All right, I'm going to do some composing.
Okay.
While we listen to Mike Scott read the news.
Somebody texted Neil Diamond coming to America. I'm not feeling that. But, yeah, we'll
let
you know.
Maybe James Brown living in America.
That's not bad.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The 8:30 slot, we'll revisit that Kinzinger Fare Thee Well letter. We're working through some different musical arrangements on that to make sure we do a dramatic reading that's up to this show's standard. So you'll have to bear with us on that.
Yeah, and please keep texting them in at 64636. Type in DA, then let us know because we're blowing up here on the suggestions.
I don't usually like this device because I think it's a bit overused, and then it becomes a bit sentimentalist. But for some reason, Mike Bossy's letter, I thought, was really good. Not for some reason. It was because it was good. For some reason, this one moved me. Mike Bossy is a New York Islanders great NHL Hall of Famer who passed away last week at the age of 65. And he did this letter to my younger self.
Oh, yeah. I saw your tweet about that. And it was really nice.
This is a few years ago, and I guess he had a bit of an extended battle with cancer. So this is writing to his younger self, writing to his 14-year-old self as a 60-year-old man. And so it sort of prompted some thinking because I thought he did a nice job of not just like, wasn't like regrets. It was more writing to my 14-year-old self about the people that are going to be important in your life. Mm-hmm. And about the things that you did as a young man that will lead you to do other things, and in his case, great things, like have a great NHL career later in life. Thinking about this, what would you say to your younger self along the lines of what Mike Bossy said when you're about to hear it, but you get the gist of where I'm going. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line 64636DA, Turnkey.pro text line. And it's sort of not admonition so much as what the world is 46 years later. Dear 14-year-old Mike, I write to you today as a 60-year-old man. There are 30 teams in the NHL, and next year there's going to be one in Las Vegas. Can you believe it? Guys don't smoke cigarettes and drink black coffee at intermission anymore. They drink smoothies and stretch. I love it.
That's so true.
The going rate for a 50-goal scorer is about $9 million a year. He's writing this stuff like he can't, right?
He can't believe
at 60 what is true. And fighting is considered a dying art. I know that one probably sounds pretty good to you right now. You're about to experience more than your fair share of violence. In fact, the reason I'm writing to you now is because you're about to go through one of the toughest times you'll ever have to face. I hope you have enjoyed your beautiful nose for the past 14 years, because pretty soon it's not going to be so straight anymore. It talks about his junior team in Quebec and moving around. He writes, until now, your parents have been raising their 10 kids in a 4.5-room apartment in Montreal. You've never even had a real bedroom. You've been sleeping on a cot at the end of the hallway behind a little curtain. When you think about hockey, you don't visualize the Montreal Canadiens in their red and white sweaters. You hear the Montreal Canadiens. That's because your father always makes you go to bed right before hockey night in Canada starts. He pulls the curtain shut, but your cot is right outside the living room, so you always stay up anyway and listen to the TV. You don't have vivid memories of the Canadians, but you have vivid memories of hearing Danny Gallivan's voice go up a few notches whenever Jean Beliveau would touch the puck. And then he talks about, you know, continuing to grow up and progress as he's a hockey standout as a kid. Natural goal scorer. You'll be known as a natural goal scorer. There's nothing natural about it, actually. That's something that will bother you for the rest of your life. When people ever ask you, why was scoring so easy for you, Mike? It was never easy. Your mother loves to tell people the story about how you scored 21 goals in your first Mite hockey game. But even if that story is true, the goals only tell a part of the story. Because your mom always leaves out the part about how much time you spent all by yourself out in the backyard rink shooting at a wooden board. You don't have a real net, so you practice by aiming the black puck marks on the board, aiming at the black pucks, puck marks on the board over and over until your feet are frozen. For whatever reason, some people will resent you for being a goal scorer. Other teams are going to target you big time. You get jumped from behind, sucker punch, completely knocked out by blindside hits. In the future, there's a serious injury called a concussion. You don't know what this is yet, but unfortunately, you're going to have quite a few. And he goes on to talk about the career and, you know, the trials and tribulations. But you have to keep going. You have to keep going for two reasons. If you don't quit, you'll set the record for goals in junior hockey and make it to the NHL. Number one. Number two, that girl behind the counter at the snack bar.
Number two is far more important reason.
Yeah.
That's what he wrote.
Right. And he writes, you're too shy to actually talk to her, so you'll go up and buy a chocolate bar from her every single day before practice.
Aww.
Well, eventually you're going to need to work up the courage to have a real conversation with her, maybe even ask her what her name is. It's Lucy, by the way. Her brother's the coach of the midget team, and he's a pretty tough guy, so you better make damn sure that you're a gentleman. This is the girl who's going to be by your side for the rest of your life. She's a huge hockey fan, and nobody, not even you, is going to be harder on your performance. And then he talks about getting into the NHL. They'll want nothing to... 12 teams will pass. They'll want nothing to do with you. They'll think you're too timid. They'll think you're not tough enough to score in the NHL. Finally, you'll get a call from a guy named Bill Torrey welcoming you to the New York Islanders. He's the GM, and he's in the process of building a dynasty. And he talks a bit about a learning lesson here, too. Please, please, please just let your agent handle the contract negotiations. Can I change this future with this letter? If I can, I'd like you to do something for me. When you sit down with Bill, the GM, and he makes you a lowball offer in a contract, just let your agent do the talking. Let him compare the deal with other rookie deals. This is just how business works. You want to know what you did? Don't do this. Yeah.
That's sound advice.
He goes on that the Islanders brought you in to score goals, which brings me to my next piece of advice. Just leave your coach alone. Al Arbor doesn't want to talk to you, kids. Legendary hockey coach, for those who don't know hockey. For the first two or three practices, you'll keep skating up to Al during breaks and asking what you should be doing in your own zone. Coach, what am I supposed to be on the wall? Coach, when the puck is behind the net, am I in the right spot? Coach, finally, I'll shut you up. Mike? Yes, coach. Mike, do you know why we brought you here? Well, Mike, we brought you here to score goals. Can you score goals for us? Well, Mike, don't bother me about your defense ever again. If I have anything to say to you about your defense, I'll come and see you, okay? You'll speak to Al maybe two or three more times the rest of the season. And then he talks about this teammate who became his best friend, Brian Trottier. Al doesn't need to speak to you because he's got a guy named Brian Trottier keeping you in check. He's going to be your best friend in hockey. I should warn you now, though, he's a Western Canadian guy with a funny little mustache and he can barely shoot a puck through a paper bag. Certainly doesn't look like a physical specimen, but he's one of the strongest centers you'll ever come across, and he works on every aspect of his game. He's the complete hockey player. And you're going to develop such an unbelievable chemistry with him that you guys won't be able to keep a left winger. They'll always complain that you and Brian are just passing the puck back and forth to one another. It's kind of true, but it works. At some point, you'll tell Brian, you don't need to see me, just my stick. As long as you can see my stick, put it there. And that's what helped him score 53 goals in his rookie season. Wow. And Trottier hits 46. And then just going through this, so the Lucy, the girl, Al, the coach, Brian Trottier, his best friend in hockey. And he just concludes, well, a couple things. My biggest piece of advice for you is to try to remember more of it. As sad as it is to say, as I write to you at 60 years old, I can barely remember anything about lifting those Stanley Cups. Wow. I don't know if it's all the hits I took or just because how overwhelmed I was at the time, but I really can't remember much. What I do remember is Brian with the cup. I have a vivid memory of him going completely ape blank, racing around the ice with the cup above his head at Nassau Coliseum. I can see him standing on the bench with it, egging on the crowd. I can see him jumping on Billy Smith after we won our fourth cup in the row. My advice to you, remember more and cherish your time more because your time is going to be shorter than you think. He goes on to say, we don't get to write the beginning and ending of our story, but we can't stay up late listening to the sounds of hockey night in Canada. We can't talk to the girl at the snack bar. We can't stop smoking cigarettes after our rookie year. We can run over Mel Bridgman, the famous incident where he leveled this enforcer named Mel Bridgman. We can't look back and say, thank God I was an Islander and I love you, Brian Trottier. And I just thought it was such a cool way to look back on your life and, you know, Dad and the hockey night experience and how he got his love of hockey and developed his skills that would fuel him through junior hockey to NHL to the Hall of Fame. And obviously the wife and the coach, the mentor, and the best friend in hockey, Trottier, and just piece that all together, not as what I regret doing so much. I mean, he's very sort of matter of fact about the things he didn't know that you learn and how things have changed, but he's not complaining about it. He's just describing it. And I just thought that was sort of a cool, for lack of a better description, epitaph that he wrote for himself that I think has a value beyond his life. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I particularly like that what he remembers about the Stanley Cup was Trottier holding up the cup.
Yeah, not
to
himself.
Show. And because it's just and that's the cool thing about sport, which has been completely subordinated to all the politics, unfortunately, because it's like in Tin Cup or Bull Durham. Or this new movie that's out. I don't know if people have seen it, but you should see it, called Jockey. Clifton Collins plays an aging jockey. It's really good. It's not about winning and losing, although obviously he was part of a dynasty, so that's something. I'm talking about Bossy. But it's that camaraderie you have, just being one of the guys, as it were, playing, and all of the experiences you have with and the camaraderie you build and the drama entailed in being a professional hockey player, a jockey, a baseball player, a golfer, et cetera. I just thought, I just think, I don't know, I like stories like that because they're not maudlin and they're not bitching and they don't have a political motivation. They have something that is very unifying. It's very human. And it sort of conveys that transcendental aspect of sport that's difficult to convey but for participating in it. But for some reason, I read this letter and I thought of those films and in the context of sport. I don't know.
What would your letter be to your younger self?
I thought I should. My letter, move out of Illinois earlier. Why did you stay so long? Go someplace warm, faster.
Because life is short. In your years, you don't know how many days you're going to have on this planet.
You don't get to write the beginning and ending, as Mike Bossy said. So true. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and Tom Jones is his name, not Hello Pussycat Tom Jones.
Oh, yeah. I
presume.
No, it's not.
Tom Jones is an extreme athlete. He's going to run 76 marathons in 76 consecutive days.
Oh.
Why? Why would someone do that? Well, he's doing it on behalf of an organization called United We Pledge, UnitedWePledge.org. Why don't we find out why he would do something so absurd? Tom Jones, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Actually, it's Dennis. Tom Jones
actually,
is getting ready.
Yeah. Tom Jones is getting ready to run. My name is Dennis Levitt. I'm the president of United We
Pledge. Dennis,
Jones is, he's just getting ready this morning. I want to meet up with him in about a half an hour. We've got a little program to send him off, and he is getting last-minute preparations in today.
Well, why don't you run with him?
Exactly. You and me both. You do the first half of every day, and I'll do the second half of every day.
May drive it, maybe. All right. So then,
I wouldn't even want to drive it. By the way,
as his spokesperson, then what? Why is Tom Jones doing something so absurd?
Yeah, he's an ex-Marine. He's an extreme athlete, and he loves the United States of America. He's passionate about youth, and we approached Tom from United with Pledge's perspective and said, Tom, we want to raise awareness for an American village that we're going to be building in the western part of the United States, and we want to raise awareness for youth, for the Constitution, for the United States of America. And he said, I'm all in. My gut told me yes. My heart said, I've got to do this, and my head said, okay, I'll do it one more time. He's done some crazy things. But he just loves the youth and wants to make sure that the republic and the freedoms that we enjoy are passed on to them through education.
Well, you should tell people. So the American Village is in Alabama. And how, you know, just tell us what that is, because I know that it's an immersed environment through full-size replications of significant buildings such as Independence Hall. And there's also interpretive actors and reenactments and educational programs for kids to really, you know, teach them about the Constitution, which seems to have been lost on our youth.
Yeah, that's right. We're here in Montevallo, Alabama today, actually, at the American Village. It was established 20 years ago. They bring in tens of thousands of youth every day and school-aged children and give them this real-life experience of stepping back on the stage of American history. It's a fantastic campus with, like you said, life-size replicas of all these historic buildings, and they have this hands-on, engaging kind of educational program for youth. And it's so magical that we knew that in the western part of the United States, youth just don't have that opportunity. You've got to travel back to the East Coast to even see those things. Most of the youth who never get that chance. So we said we're going to duplicate that campus in the West. So Tom Jones, we're digging up a sapling here in just a little while. Today's a historical day, the day the shot was heard around the world, that anniversary date. And so there's going to be a sapling dug up. He's going to run 76 consecutive marathons, land at this campus in Washington County, Utah, and we're going to plant them there and break ground on July 2nd for the second American village in the United States. We're very thrilled about it.
I would bet that less than 1 in 10 Americans could name the battle associated with the shot heard around the world. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Those that the youth that have attended the American Village, they're the one out of every 10 that could tell you that in Lexington and Concord that mm-hmm. those battles began on today, April mm-hmm. 19th.
Wow. Well, why did you want to get involved with the project?
We have that same passion of patriotism. We feel like it needs to be reignited in America's youth. All it takes is one generation of not teaching youth, then we lose what we've got, right? We're not willing to be that generation who uses our resources in order to help further the cause of patriotism. Balance of Nature, you're familiar with them probably. They're very patriotic in their love for this land. They've pledged that whatever donations come in, they'll match those donations. They're very much behind this project, and we found great men and women who just don't want to let the legacy of this nation die.
Well, it's more than in previous generations where you have just the need to pass on what is true. In this generation now, you have to combat a concerted effort to present something that's false, things like the 1619 Project. So it sort of accentuates the need for what you're doing that much more.
Yeah, and that's what's so wonderful about the American Village. The interpreters, the actors and actresses who are on site stay in character all day, every day. And as school children come, the rule of their campus is they have to be true to the journal entries of. They don't just make things up on the fly. They don't ad lib in any way. They stay true to Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, all of those men and women in our history who may not be without blemish, of course, but whose efforts and sacrifice, those things made the difference in our lives, and we want to perpetuate those. And the most important thing we can do is give an accurate history. That's the message.
Are you going to have Village. Are you going to have actors there playing members of Antifa or Black Lives Matter call for renaming of some of these buildings?
Yeah, I don't think they're necessarily. I guess everyone's welcome, but their voice wouldn't be welcome. Mm-hmm. Youth need to hear the truth.
Yep. And it's something that is missing on the West Coast. And it's going to be great because it'll right be near Zion National Park. And people come from all over to go to that because it's on the way to Zion.
Yeah, Zion National Park attracts 4.3 million visitors per year. It's one of the most popular national parks in America. And youth and families, of course, both from the United States as well from abroad. We think the message of the Republic of Liberty is a message that ought to resonate around the world. Specifically, we don't want the youth in the United States to lose it, but we think that the campus that we'll break ground for on July 2nd is in a real premier spot in order to help further the message that the American Village in Montevallo started 20 years ago.
All right, so this Tom Jones, Marine, how old is he?
He's 59 years old.
Oh my God.
He ran 121 consecutive marathons to raise funds for youth, in 2020, basically,
For parks.
A long time.
Yeah.
He's going to run nearly 2,000 miles across 7 states over the next 45 days. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
No, 76 days.
Days,
straight marathons. So he's leaving on the day the shot was heard around the world, 76 days of marathons, and then that takes him to July 2nd,
the day of signing the Declaration.
He's coming in right there on groundbreaking day for this historic event.
Wow.
And tell us a little bit more about United We Pledge. The broad array of things that you do. Obviously, this is a huge undertaking, but what you've been doing since your inception to promote those ideals and an understanding of America's history, as you were describing.
Yeah, United We Pledge is established to promote traditional American values, freedom, family, faith. We do that through education. We believe that that's the gateway of really making a difference in helping preserve the values and the things that we enjoy. So we do freedom summits. We go to local high schools and other areas and have some one-day summits where we can, again, have really good, frank, candid conversation with youth about accurate history. We're publishing curriculum in conjunction with the American Village here, a curriculum that's based on, accurate and journal entry history so that we're capturing those things that families can enjoy. The American Village Project will break ground in July and expect ribbon cutting on July 4th, 2026, the 250th anniversary of America. So between educational programs and outreach, curriculum to families, building a campus where youth can come. That's what we really do and where we really spend our efforts and time.
And how could people get involved or donate or even volunteer?
Or run with Tom Jones during the next 76 days.
Yeah.
People do run.
Actually, if you go to UnitedWePledge.org, there is the trail that he's going to follow. He's got a real-time tracker on him, so you could follow Tom Jones on his journey. We'd love everyone to get involved in social media ways. You know, like him, follow him, comment. He'll respond as he goes along the way. He's got stops in all of the little towns along the way to lecture and, you know, to go and make appearances, everything from schools to VFW posts, and anyone who will want to run with him along the way, he'll be happy to have that experience happen. You can see, like I said, his journey on UnitedWePledge.org. That's where you could sign up to volunteer or donate, and we need people just like you're doing it, helping unite people across the nation in a really great cause and doing it for the youth.
Well, it's a really unique way to raise funds. And I know he's a patriot, he's a former Marine, but how did you get him involved?
Tom actually came to us. I was with Balance of Nature, and Tom called me out of the blue and he said, "Hey, an athlete training friend of mine told me I need to take this Balance of Nature and make a difference." He said, "I started taking it several weeks ago," and he said, "Really, it's helped my training, it's helped my recovery." And I didn't know him at all. He pestered me he's intense. He pestered me for 2 or 3 months, and finally, and he said, "I'm going to be involved in some way or another." So finally we said, "Tom, yeah, come on board, let's do some things." And we came up with this idea of running, and he was just all in. He said, "I will do this. This is what I want to do." So it was his determination, kind of his quit-proof attitude that approached us saying, "I'm going to make a difference in this world." And he felt like this was the vehicle to really do it.
Has this dude been in one of those Balance of Nature commercials? Do I see him like water skiing or something in one of those commercials?
Yeah, that's Tom Jones.
Yeah. I knew
Dan,
I
And if you take Balance of Nature, you can run marathons too, Dan.
I don't want to. I don't want to do what's required to get into the shape to run 76 marathons in 76 days. I'm not going to do it. I'm with Dennis. I'll encourage Tom. I'll give him tips like, hey, make sure you hydrate. You know, 2,000 miles.
Down.
That's all. Yeah.
If
exactly.
Your legs hurt, move your arms more. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Stuff like
yeah.
That.
All right. All right. So
but I would tell you on the radio, if you ever get a chance over the next 76 days, we could get him online. He'd be happy to do some interviews, you know, talk through things. He's a guy who's just going to be pounding it out. I said to him, "Are you going to make it for sure?" He said, "If I have to, you know, run, crawl, roll, I'm going to make it. There will be nothing that stops me." We're excited for him.
He may be crawling. I mean, on the 2,000 miles on your joints? Good Lord. He may be crawling by the end of it. But,
and then the inclines, too, through the mountains? Ooh. But he'll do it. He'll make it.
And he's running through, you know, the Dallas area, Albuquerque, Phoenix. Imagine running through Phoenix in June. You have to really want to, right? You've got to have
early.
A passion for what he's doing. That's right.
Well, I'm just happy that somebody's actually running for that has a point. There's actually a point to running. It's not just running for its own sake, which I don't understand. So this makes sense to me.
Good.
All right. Tom Jones, 76 marathons in 76 days for United We Pledge, UnitedWePledge.org. You just heard Dennis telling us all about the organization, what they're trying to do with this village in the western part of the United States, and what they do to promote American history and American values. Great stuff. Dennis Levitt, President, United We Pledge, UnitedWePledge.org. Thanks so much for joining us. Good luck, and extend our best wishes for Tom.
I'll do it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dennis. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and how much of the 2,000 miles are you going to run with Tom Jones, speaking of that Miss Balance of Nature girl?
I wouldn't even. I've done 3 Chicago marathons, and that after the third
in
one.
In a row?
No, 3 years in, every season. But yeah, no. I could never imagine running 3 marathons 3 days in a row.
Did you
Let
beat
alone
Oprah's time?
76.
Did you beat Oprah when you ran?
You know, you always, you and one of my producers, Wilson Toy, always he's like, "Oh, Carol Marine beat you. She beat your time," and he laughed. So then I did the marathon the next day to beat Carol Marine's time in the marathon.
Comarine's like 90 years old.
No, back then she was not 90.
Well, she was still 40 years older than you back then.
Yeah, so I beat
the age discrepancy
time.
Hasn't changed.
I'm trying to think what. No, I finally beat Carol's time, but it took me two marathons.
Oh my gosh,
Carol's time. And yes, I beat Oprah's time. The first one was 5:20. The second one was 4:50, I believe, and I can't remember the third one, but it was under 5 hours.
Why don't you run the Chicago Marathon this year to raise money for Governor Jelly Belly's lap band surgery?
Is he going to get it?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Suggesting a worthy cause like United We Pledge, you know, something like that. The Bidens had a little Easter celebration at the White House yesterday on the South Lawn. They did the Easter egg roll is back after a 2-year hiatus because of, you know, their policies. You know, the outtakes don't really inspire any more confidence in the big guy than he's been inspiring for the past year and a half.
Oh, no. What happened?
This is after he's done speechifying from the veranda to the families that showed up for the Easter egg roll. Take a listen. Listen closely to Jill.
Okay.
Thank you and happy, happy Easter. All right.
Wave to the nice people. Wave to the nice people, and then he dutifully waves. Then later, I don't know if you saw some of this, he's milling about where the Easter egg hunt is going to happen.
Yeah.
And he starts blathering on to some people behind the fence about Afghanistan and Pakistan unintelligibly.
What?
I'm not sure if he knows that we're out of Afghanistan, but he's talking about, and the Easter Bunny comes over and takes him away from the people. So the Easter Bunny is one of his advance people now, or his handlers, and then takes him away and then walks him towards the middle of the grounds, you know, that's roped off with fencing. And then he's sort of like after that speech last week in North Carolina where he gave the phantom handshake. There was nobody there.
Nobody was there.
And then he sort of looked around. No, there's nobody on stage. Then he sort of shuffled off the stage, and he's looking for somebody to talk to or somebody to direct him. That's sort of what he did after the Easter Bunny moved him.
Oh, my God. I'm watching
you away from
right
the nice
now.
People. Boy.
Yeah, and though at least the Easter Bunny was unmasked. Last year, remember, they just did it from afar, and the Easter Bunny, who's in a costume, had a mask on. But, yeah, today, yeah, so basically one of his handlers was dressed as the Easter Bunny and took him away from answering reporters' questions and talking to people
please,
in the crowd.
Please wave that Joe Biden is going to go down with please clap as the a political epitaph.
Oh, this is bad. We should tweet this out.
Marty in Naperville. Hey, Marty.
About Tom Jones. You ask about Tom Jones doing the marathon?
Yeah.
Not unusual.
Hi-o. Thanks for the call, Marty. Will the women be throwing their underwear at Tom Jones while he runs 2,000 miles through half a dozen states?
You guys are so bad.
Different Tom Jones.
Yes, yeah, coming up. Mike Scott's laughing his face off. Coming
That's
up.
A nice reference. That was good.
Thank you.
Pulling from 1967?
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We've talked a lot about inflation and its big brother, stagflation. So I don't know if we're going to find anything new here, but it's worth a shot. Nathan Lewis is an expert on money and taxation. He's the co-author of the book Inflation, What Is It? Why Is It? Why It's Bad and How to Fix It. He co-authored this book with a journalist named Elizabeth Ames and Mr. Hope, Growth and Opportunity himself, Steve Forbes. Nathan Lewis, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, Dan. It's great to be here.
So how to fix it? I think we know wealth tax, $3.5 billion Green New Deal, easy money at the Fed, and the rest sort of takes care of itself. That's my understanding from the Biden administration.
I think you've been reading the newspapers.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that right?
Sarcastic.
Is that wrong?
Well, probably about half the country thinks, will probably agree with you on that one. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, you know, we do have a very bad history of diagnosing and fixing these inflationary episodes. And unfortunately, this is true on the right as on the left. On the right, we often get the, well, what we really need is a recession to break the back of inflation. We're kind of getting that now. And like, you know, we got these supply chain issues. We got ports clogged up. We've got, you know, the factories aren't running. I'm not sure that more unemployment is a solution for that one. Don't worry. We've got problems on both sides.
Well, yeah, on the unemployment side or the job opening side, the combination of the two, I saw that HHS Secretary just extended the public health emergency for COVID another 90 days to keep the transfer payments flowing. We now have 1.8 job openings for every unemployed worker, and we have nearly 2.5 million more American households receiving food stamps than were pre-pandemic in 2019. The work requirement having been relaxed. So to some extent, you know, you hear both sides. You hear Jason Furman, Obama's former econ advisor, saying, you know, the tight labor market, not necessarily a good thing. The flip side is you have all sorts of disincentives to work, and companies that aren't operating at capacity would like to hire more people, and they can't seem to find them. So on the labor market side, where are we, in your opinion, vis-a-vis these inflationary problems we have?
That's a good point, actually, because as just mentioned, there's getting to be this consensus that what we really need is more unemployment. Obviously, clearly, in this kind of environment, there's hardly any justification for these, you know, welfare, you know, paying people not to work kind of programs. There's plenty of jobs available. But I would say that, you know, rising wages because of a tight labor market, maybe that's a good thing, right? Isn't that what the lower middle class has been waiting for the last 30, 40 years? And there's definitely some bad inflationary effects going on. There's definitely been central bank stress, but, you know, tight labor market, maybe it should be tight all the time.
Well, do you think it's a good idea here in Chicago? You can make 24 bucks an hour working at Target.
Yeah, well, so one of the things that we have to take into consideration here that, you know, the value of the currency, the value of the dollar, has fallen quite a lot over the last 20 years or so since the 90s. You know, in the 90s, I used to buy gas for 85 cents, right, $20 a barrel for oil, and wages haven't really kept up with that. So to some degree, I see this upward adjustment as you know, sort of a good thing.
Well, yeah, the modern monetary theorist, though, tells us that there is no downside to printing money, to propping up the equities market. It's just all good news, and we should do more of it as so our hearts desire.
Well, that's one of the reasons why we wanted to come out and get this book out there, because there's definitely a risk that we've seen in the last recession. In the last 15 years, governments around the world have gotten this habit of, well, we're just going to spend incredible amounts of money, and we're going to have the central bank help pay for it. And in the last recession, we actually ran a 15% of GDP deficit, unheard of outside of wartime. You know, World War II was about the last time we did that sort of thing. And the central bank, you know, Federal Reserve picked up most of the tab. And clearly, I think, to some degree, the economy has absorbed that excess money. It actually had some need for it. But our estimation is that if they try to pull that again, it could be very nasty.
So, I mean, we're hearing conflicting things on so many fronts, including on the prospect of a recession, even though we have double-digit inflation, we have an economy that is slowing down considerably, maybe zero GDP growth in the second quarter. But we're not supposed to worry about stagflation, according to some of the big banks. And we're not looking at a recession anytime soon, depending on how quickly the Fed increases interest rates. What's your handle on how things are proceeding in response to this this inflation over the last year?
I would definitely agree that the trend that we're seeing now is that we're supposed to have, you know, very aggressive Fed rate hikes. I don't really buy that argument. But you know, the basic outcome, the Fed itself is practically saying that it wants to have a recession. And what, you know, the question I see is, what is going to be the outcome of that? You know, 12, 18 months from now, higher unemployment doesn't sound like so much fun anymore. And are we going to have that swing that we've had so many times in the past? You know, basically, the Fed puts, right, where central banks around the world get busy again on the easy money side. And we have another cycle of declining currency value and inflationary price hikes.
Well, when you say you don't buy the Fed's going to get aggressive with interest rates, you mean you don't think it's going to happen, or you don't think it's going to help?
We don't really have an interest rate targeting system anymore. This is kind of, you know, very technical central bank stuff. But we've had all this focus over the decades about, you know, central banks, they go make interest rates go up and down. They actually don't really do that anymore since 2008. They have a new system. And it's much more important to look at the value of the currency. That's, you know, one of the things we focus on in the book. It's not about interest rates. It's not about, you know, growth and recession. It's about keeping the value of the currency stable. And as certainly you and your listeners know, that's what we did in the United States with the gold standard system in the United States until 1971. And we need to, even if we don't necessarily adopt gold standard again in the future, we need to adopt that basic principle of keeping the currency stable in value. And if we do that, that should be a good thing, right? That should cause growth and a healthy economy, not a recession to break the back of inflation.
Yeah, but so then what's the prescription to do that in a post Bretton Woods world? Do we adopt something like, I mean, if we had different policy leadership, obviously, something like the Friedman rule, or what exactly is the approach? Because this is just, seems to me, as you're describing, mysticism by Jay Powell and the Fed Board of Governors.
Right. Well, we've had this system since 1971 of make it up as go along. And the result of that is, after 50 years, the value of the dollar, according to my estimate, is worth about 1/50th of what it was worth in the 60s. I said we have a 2-cent dollar. And during those 50 years, you know, did the Federal Reserve or the U.S. Treasury Department ever say, oh, we want lots of inflation and we want to depreciate the currency? They never said that. It just happened along the way. And we could see the potential for kind of that continuing and perhaps accelerating. We're getting this kind of, you know, oh, now we need a recession. And then when the recession comes, now we need easy money to deal with the recession. That's kind of how that happens.
So are you... So do you guys, I mean, because here's the thing, you know, people say, well, why don't we go back to the gold standard? So, well, that's not possible in this world, or something like that, fixing the dollar to a hard asset. That's not possible. Mm-hmm. The left proposes things that are not possible all the time, that are also terrible when attempted even to go down that road. Why don't we have free marketeers proposing something like that, given how moving away from the gold standard has destroyed the value of the dollar, as you were describing? Is that what you're proposing? Should we be proposing that?
I've written 3 books about the gold standard. We did it in the United States for nearly 200 years until 1971. And while we stuck to it, we never had an inflation problem. And also along the way, we became the wealthiest country in the history of the world. We were not a country that needed to be made great again in the late 60s. We were just a great country.
That sounds like a yes, then.
Yeah, so, but the important thing is not just, oh, you know, gold. I kind of like this kind of religious attachment to gold, but to understand why that worked. By fixing the value of the currency to gold, and gold is pretty stable in value, you make your currency stable in value, as stable as gold.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, basically the same principle is followed by the majority of more than 50% of all the countries in the world today do basically the same thing. They've also tried floating fiat currencies. They've also tried their homegrown central bankers making stuff up as they go along. And they also had kind of the same outcome that we did, but usually much worse. And they said, you know what, let's just fix the currency, our currency, to the dollar or the euro. And then we won't have foreign exchange issues, and, you know, they're better managed than we do. So it'll work out. So it's basically the same principle that most of the countries do today, but we would, instead of, we can't fix the dollar to the dollar, obviously, so we would fix the dollar to gold. That's how we did things throughout the world for 500 years until 1971.
Yeah. Well, in the environment we're actually in now, as opposed to that one, what do you see? I mean, people want to know where to put their money. If the Fed stops the propping up the equities market, that doesn't seem like a good place. It seems like your choice is T-bills or buy a home, even in a 5% mortgage environment. Borrowing at 5% and paying it back a year from now in dollars that have depreciated by 10%, still a good deal.
Yeah, property, if we assume that, if we project that we're going to have substantial further decline in currency value from here, which I think is pretty likely, property in the past has done pretty well, but you have to buy it at the right price. You can't buy something you can't afford. And with mortgage rates going up, that's becoming a problem. If it's something that's, you know, you can swing the payments, then yes, you might have your mortgage inflated away as people in the 1970s did. I think gold itself, as an investment asset, is still, you know, it's the risk free asset, right? We had all this talk about, you know, treasury bonds are a risk free asset. Well, no, not really. Gold is traditionally a risk free asset, and I think that's going to prove itself over the next 10 years or so.
But
stocks and bonds are very expensive.
And if you you and Steve Forbes were advising Jay Powell on what to do now that he and others have put themselves in this predicament and the country along with them, what would you say about how aggressive to be with respect to interest rate hikes?
I would tend to ignore it. What the Fed needs to do and what Volcker and Greenspan did in the 80s and 90s is stabilize the value of the dollar. And it's been around, dollar's been around $1,800, $1,900 per ounce of gold for a while here. We still think gold is the best indicator. But if you don't like gold, find, you know, whatever floats your boat. But you're going to have to keep the value of the currency stable. And that will, over time, eventually solve the problem. Dealing right now is basically the depreciation we had in 2019, 2020. We saw the dollar go from about $1,200 per ounce to about, you know, $1,800, $1,900 today, almost $2,000. And so that is kind of flushing through the price system. And there are things you can do about that, but for the most part, it's baked into the cake. But going forward, just as Volcker and Greenspan did in the 80s, 90s, they didn't go to a gold standard system, but they did stabilize the value of the currency during those decades, and it worked pretty well.
He is Nathan Lewis. He's an expert on money and taxation. He's also the co-author of the new book, along with Steve Forbes and journalist Elizabeth Ames, Inflation, What Is It, Why It's Bad, and How to Fix It. Nathan Lewis, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You switch to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat Socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House Law for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out. When you're moving out.
At Theme Music Means, it's time for our weekly conversation with Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, we find out, just what we found out a few months back, the only thing that Illinois lacks, good marketing campaign. That's why tourism is down. That's why people are fleeing. There's just not an appreciation for all that Illinois has to offer. People don't understand what's actually happening in Illinois. They're just addled by some of the bad news, some of the unpleasantness. But Jelly Belly rolled out a $30 million ad campaign yesterday, highlighting Illinois as a cultural touchstone with a new slogan, Middle of Everything.
Illinois is in the middle. And what do you find in the middle?
The meeting point of humanity and history.
It's the middle of the architectural revolution.
Oh, we have a revolution?
In the middle of the rainbow.
Welcome to the middle of everything.
And they got the pickle bucket guys to do the soundtrack for it, which is nice. Middle of everything.
Yeah.
Jelly Belly in the middle of everything.
That's going to change it all. Right.
We do have a governor physically in the middle of everything. I don't know that Illinois is located in the middle of everything. Illinois has all these advantages that are well documented. And you hear from every politician, all that we have, all the natural assets that we have that we frittered away dutifully. So, Ted, will $30 million in ads in other states convince people to ignore the, the violent crime that Chicago has, that has become Chicago's signature? What do you think?
No, I don't think so.
Ted, are you there?
Ted? Oh, my gosh.
They cut Ted off.
We'll have to see if we can re-raise Ted there. It seems like that Chicago campaign, too. Chicago not in Chicago. That's one of my favorite slogans.
Right. I forgot about that.
Chicago not in Chicago. It's intended to be a campaign that details all that Chicago has spawned.
Right.
All that Chicagoans have done that have impacted the world. And that may have been true once upon a time. Now it's more Chicago not in Chicago, like former Chicagoans who live in other places now after fleeing the city. So I don't know, a bit of a double entendre there. Sounds like they're a bit up their own behinds in terms of what's actually happening in Chicago. And the same thing goes for Illinois with an exodus, as I'm wont to say, not seen since the Israelites fled Egypt. But okay, it's just an ad problem, or it's just a marketing problem. That's all we have here. There's no fundamental problems. Ted, we got you again?
Yeah, I'm back.
All right, again, Chicago, in Chicago, Illinois in the middle of everything. Is that going to persuade people to come back to the Mag Mile and dodge bullets?
No, I don't think it is. I think, for sure it's better than I think you're just mentioning when I got cut off. You're just mentioning the Chicago, not in Chicago. I mean, it's a lot better than saying go to New York to see Chicago. So from that perspective, it's better. But, $30 million, I'm surprised that, Pritzker, who's had, these billions that he's been spending on so many programs, I'm surprised he's not putting a couple hundred million behind it, or maybe even half a billion behind it. Because, think about what he's got to overcome now. You've got this, over 1,000 murders in Cook County. So everybody knows that that's as big a campaign, because it's covered by every newspaper and TV station across the country. He's got to overcome that campaign. You've got the capacity of buildings at, what, maybe 30% right now. So a lot of people aren't coming in. You've had a policy that's destroyed a lot of the small restaurants and things like that. So it's going to be tough. And we're going to need much more than a campaign, especially since there's a lot of other cities to go visit that have a lot less crime.
But have you noticed, though, like New York, California, they're doing the same thing. Every time I turn on TV, I see, come visit New York, or California's open now. So all these Democratic states are desperate to have people come back to their states.
Because the only people dumb enough to go to New York or California are in Chicago.
Well, they're going to have to do a lot, right? They had the harshest lockdown policies. They've had the worst anti-crime policies, and so and you're starting to see them having to undo a lot of the progressive mess they made. We just wrote about that this morning. All the things they're having to do, and this is one of them. When you make a mess of your city through bad progressive policies, well, you need to spend money to get people to come here again. And they're having to make up for bad decisions with unfortunately more bad decisions.
Well, the good news is I understand from the governor that we are, as a state, in the strongest financial position we've been in many generations. And so we can afford to throw a little money at marketing the state to other states.
Yeah, it's fascinating that he actually came out in this tweet that we're the best position in Illinois we've been in decades. Oh, it's like, Lies. Does he not know that there's a couple watchdogs that might challenge him on that? You know, Illinois is still the worst rated state in the country, and a lot of that has to do with all the debts. We had a
credit rating,
credit upgrades.
Yeah,
credit rating. Sorry, worst credit rating in the country. You know, New Jersey, who's the other fiscal basket case in the country, is three notches higher than we are. In other words, they're much better rated than we are. So we've got a long, long way to go before we're considered best in decades.
Well, so at 10 o'clock this morning, Governor Pritzker is going to sign the 2023 budget that delivers $1.8 billion in tax relief and supports education, healthcare, human services. Anything true in this?
No, I mean, that's the whole thing is that, yeah, there's some money that's coming back to taxpayers, but it's trivial, it's worthless. And, you know, considering the inflation and, you know, he was a big part of the whole group of leaders in the country that pushed for all these bailouts that led to all this inflation. So, you know, Pritzker owns a lot of this inflation just as being one of the cheerleaders of more printing and free money. So he's doing some things to try to make things better, but, you know, in the scope of things, his 2 cent, you know, gas tax quote relief is, you know, like we talked about before, it's not a cut. It's just a suspension and an increase. And property taxes are going to go up by the max allowed by the state. And so they're going to go up and undo anything he tries to do with property taxes. And of course, if you look at the prices of beef and gas and milk and anything, you know, cereal, when you look at those prices, they're going to, you know, just grossly outpace the 1% savings that he's putting on the grocery tax. So,
all right,
Governor Pritzker, not much.
I'm going to channel brain dead suburban pea hat and say, but Ted, $350 million in new spending for K-12. We're finally starting to fund our woefully underfunded K-12 public school systems, and that's a great thing.
It's one of the, you know, for the last few years, it's one of the things that's driven me most crazy is I've watched, you know, even Governor Rauner sit there and say the same things, and his team said the same things. Nobody was looking at the numbers. Nobody recognized that we were spending more than virtually, you know, at least 40 states in the country on education. Right now, we spend the eighth most, and we've had the biggest increases in spending in the last decade. We spend so much money on education, we should stop spending more. And we should start figuring out how we spend it, where it goes, and how we dish it out. We should go to the voucher system. But the lie there that we need more money is just been perpetuated, and it just goes into the pension hole and into the administrator hole. People getting rich or enriching themselves off the education system, and the results don't show it at all.
I saw some good news out of California. I saw some good news out of California that more than 100,000 kids have left the California public schools systems.
Ooh.
So that's some good news. That's a start. Do we have any numbers yet on the continued attrition in Chicago public schools and other government school systems here in Illinois, Chicago?
Not any fresh ones that I've seen. What I have seen, again, is that, you know, charter schools were up. Private schools were up during the pandemic. Of course, we saw the big drop in CPS, right? Another, whatever it was, 14,000 kids that were gone. So, you know, we're talking about almost a quarter of the kids have left CPS in the last, you know, whatever it is, 10, 20 years. So it's happening, but it's happening slowly. And what's left is a system, especially CPS, is a system that doesn't work for anybody except for maybe the magnet schools where, you know, you have some pretty good stuff going there. But outside of that, we've got to see a massive change. And, you know, what is good news, Dan, and, you know, we're seeing this in polls, 70-80% of Hispanics, blacks, whites across the country and even in Illinois are pushing for some kind of vouchers, some kind of ESAs. And the COVID lockdowns and shutdowns have been a big help for that. Parents realize that they are second to teachers in the schools.
So what I hear you're saying, now correct me if I'm wrong here, is that you don't believe that legislators should have deserved, they don't deserve, they should not have raised their salaries by $2,700. But if that's true, if that's your position, I'm not saying it is because, of course, the General Assembly has been rather impressive over the last 2 years in terms of, you know, abdication, which I'm a fan of, generally speaking. But our legislators only the sixth highest paid in the nation, And, you know, I mean, we want to attract good people to the General Assembly. So, you know, we should bump their salaries.
Yeah, this is another one of those things that doesn't get enough attention is that, you know, we pay our lawmakers really well, sixth best in the country. They have great pensions as well. The newer pensions are not nearly as good as the older pensions, but you know, it's a good gig and it's a part-time job. And I've never understood why we didn't. Well, I understand why, because it's a gig here in Illinois. But, you know, Texas meets, you know, every 2 years. And I'd argue that, you know, the less time they have to plan bad things, the better. And, you know, the Texas model is much better. They get paid a lot less, much, much less. And, you know, the more we pay them, the more they have an incentive to congregate and do bad things. And that's exactly what happens, is why we end up with all these crazy laws that most other states would never have.
Interesting. On legislative salaries, I don't know if this tells you anything. I don't know if this is an indicator of anything. The highest legislative salaries, New York, Connecticut, Vermont, New Jersey, and Illinois is, I'm looking at spending, educational spending. Hold on. California, New York, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Massachusetts, Illinois. Huh. California, New York, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Massachusetts, Illinois. Those are the top six. The bottom six, North Carolina, South Dakota, South Carolina, Texas, you mentioned, New Hampshire, New Mexico. Does it tell us anything about which states, and by the way, like states like Florida, are bottom third and about one third the salary of Illinois legislators? Legislative salaries is like a leading indicator of quality of government. The more you pay means the more of a political class that you have means the worse your state is run, it seems.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, you're starting to find those correlations across everything. Last week, I think it was, we reported effective income tax rates across the different states. And it's starting to look like the same list over and over, right? The deep blue states, either really high tax rates, for example, in this case, really high salaries for lawmakers. And it's the red states or the redder states that are, you know, lower taxes, lower legislative pay, higher in migration, right? Higher growth in everything. So, yeah, we're seeing a real bifurcation between these failed policies and these, let's call them more free markets, free enterprise policies. I guess it's just playing out. And you know, we're seeing that play out in congressional representation where, you know, places like Illinois and California and these other blue states that are losing population, they're losing representation in Congress, and Florida and Texas are gaining. So, maybe there's some good news in the 50 state laboratory where people can choose where they live and they actually move to where they're more free.
You mentioned pensions. One good news story here is that Illinois has retained its title by a wide margin, number one in the nation in unfunded pension debt.
Yes, yeah, so we continue to hold that spot, and the legislature is doing a great job of making sure that we have the biggest debts in the country, and they don't want to cede that position. So I join you in your
yeah,
it's horrible.
That's, I mean, why they earned that $2,700 pay raise.
There you go. Yeah. So yeah, and their pensions get bigger. No, I think that's one of the biggest problems that continues to not be addressed, and it will be the drag that continues over the next decade. All these debts and pensions will turn into bigger tax hikes on Illinoisans. And I keep saying there's one easy way to get rid of a bunch of debt off your back, and for most people who figure that out, they leave the state, and that's a sad statement.
He is Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, WirePoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before we get to our next guest and talk about the Shanghai lockdown, as well as China's involvement with Russia in Ukraine, just a comment on our conversation with Ted Dabrowski. Because, you know, sometimes, Amy, we get feedback from listeners like, oh, you know, the get out of Illinois talk. And And I get it. I get why. But, you know, I tire of the get out of Illinois. Either I'm getting out or I can't get out. Let me explain something to folks, again, who are having trouble connecting the dots.
What?
I'm the originator of the phrase revolt or bolt.
Yes, you are.
I'm
the originator. It's not fixed. It's broken. Or it's not broken. It's fixed.
Yes. I ran for governor. Mm-hmm. I've been involved in Illinois politics for 2.5 decades. I'm involved in the governor's race right now. Are you? For those tiring of the get out message, you understand the get out message, the painstaking documenting of all that ails Illinois is a motivational message. It's a revolt or bolt message. Either you're part of fomenting the revolt, or you're just biding your time to get out and you've got an exit strategy. Fine. Understood and understandable. But the get out message isn't just throw up your hands and get out. If you have to stay, or for however long you have to stay, as I've said myriad times, you might as well do your best to foment revolt where you can. And just listening to this show is not fomenting revolt. Going to school board meetings, as we saw during the pandemic, getting involved in a local race, getting involved in the governor's race, educating your dim-witted neighbors and others within your social circles about the record of the political ruling class, both sides, the combine, the opportunities present so we don't miss one again. How many times have I said this over the last 3 months? We had this opportunity to change the course of the GOP in 2018. We chose not to do it. We have the opportunity to change the course of the GOP again in 2022. Will we choose to do it? Because you don't change the state if you don't have competitive elections. And you don't have competitive elections if you don't change the path of the Illinois Republican Party by instituting conservative reform leadership. So it's not just a get out and if you can't get out, too bad, so sad for you. That's not the message. The message is revolt. So just so we're clear on that, because it's cheap to say, I'm not going to do anything, be passive, be agreeable, but not active. And then I'm going to throw up my hands because Dan's throwing up his hands. I'm not throwing up my hands. Far from it. Okay. Anything to add to that, Amy?
No, I think what you said is perfect.
All right. Speaking of people that would be wise to get out if they can't depose their communist leadership, we're pleased to be joined again by Stephen Mosier, president of the Population Research Institute, who's an expert on China policy. He's also the author of Bully of Asia, Why Chinese Dream is the New Threat to World Order. Stephen Mosier, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
It's good to be with you, Dan and Amy.
So we're not getting as much coverage of the human rights abuses in China, surprise, surprise, yet again, this time coming in the form of the lockdown in Shanghai in particular. We've seen videos that have gone viral of Chinese communist goon squads ripping people out of their apartments in the sky. We've heard the drones telling people to go back inside, stop screaming, stop yearning for freedom. Incredible stuff, incredible Orwellian stuff. We've seen people who broke the police lines to sack a grocery store because they're starving inside their apartments.
And all the grocery store shelves are empty.
Well, now they are. Now, as you documented recently, you literally have, there's such despair. You have Chinese citizens jumping from their balconies because they can't take it anymore.
Yeah, it's a horrible situation, and you know it should resonate with every American because in many American cities and states, we were very close to being Shanghai. Let's make no mistake. There are people in our government whose last name begins with F who would like to have locked us down for weeks at a time, hoping to kill the virus by keeping us isolated in cells of fear, even if we literally starved to death, not just for human affection, but for basic necessities like food and water. The videos out of Shanghai are just heartrending. I mean, it breaks my heart to hear the screams from the high-rise apartment buildings after, you know, 3 weeks of lockdowns. People going to their balconies and screaming out in the dialect of Shanghainese, what they're saying is people are dying. They say, Yao Ming. They say, we're ready to die. We're on the verge of dying. You know, all Americans hear are the screams, but what those people are actually saying is, we're on the verge. And some of them, of course, the only way for them to get out of their apartments because they're locked in is to actually jump to their deaths from their balconies. So it's a horrible thing that's going on. It's sort of the COVID nightmare of perfect control, total lockdown come to life in China. And make no mistake, there are people in other countries of the world who attempted the same thing. They failed, but do they admit their failure? Would they like to try again with the next variant? Sure they would. So Shanghai is not just something we ought to be sympathetic towards. We ought to look at that as one of our possible futures and begin working and fighting against it.
Well, they're trying to have zero COVID, you know, cases, which is not going to happen. It's like trying to stop the cold, obviously, but it's a town of 26 million people. And how many are testing positive right now for COVID, and how many are being hospitalized?
Yeah, the numbers are just ridiculously low. You know, you've got 20,000 people. They're testing everybody every day, 26 million people. So they test and you get 20,000, 25,000 people who test positive for COVID. Who cares? Most of them, the vast majority, 95%, have no symptoms. They're not sick. They may have had a virus capsule or two that was detected by the test, but who cares? The virus is in the air everywhere. A few thousand have symptoms, but it doesn't matter whether you're symptomatic or asymptomatic. They lock everybody up. If you test positive for COVID, they take you away by force, throw you in a, well, they call it a quarantine center. It's more like a concentration camp. Very short on food and water, these concentration camps. No toilets, no showers available for the vast majority of the people in these concentration camps. And then if you happen to have a dog or cat left behind in your apartment, they kill the dog or the cat as a possible carrier of the virus. If you have a child who tests positive for COVID, the child is 1 or 2 or 3 years old, they take the child away from you and put it in a separate quarantine center. How well do you think those children are doing being taken away from their parents?
Oh,
the list of abuses goes on and on. My favorite, least favorite, picture from the whole Shanghai thing is not people jumping out the windows, I can't, or off the balconies, I can't look at those. But there's one gentleman who moved his refrigerator out on his balcony and opened the doors and showed the inside of the refrigerator was completely empty. It was a mute protest, the only kind of protest you're really allowed in the People's Republic of China, to say, I have no food, I'm starving to death. But his story is the story of millions of people.
You know, 35 years ago, the world was fixated on Tank Man standing in Tiananmen Square, and everybody covered it. And everybody talked about it. When you have similar acts of protestation, like you're describing, against the human rights abuses of the Chinese communists, it doesn't seem like we're getting the same coverage from corporate media. It doesn't seem like we're getting the same statements of solidarity with the Chinese people that we got from corporate America back 35 years ago. Something's changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, something certainly has changed. All the major media companies in the United States are making money hand over fist in China. China has a huge propaganda budget, literally tens of billions of dollars, which is being spent to buy favorable media coverage all around the world, not least in the United States. And all of these media companies, you know, some of them have investment and interest in China itself. And they know, I mean, look, Disney knows that the Shanghai Disneyland would be shut down if it produces a movie critical of China. It knows that if it produces even a single scene which puts China in a bad light, that movie will not be shown in China. That's just one way that they manipulate the media companies in the United States and massage the message so that China is always presented in a positive light if it's presented at all. So we're not hearing nearly as much about China these days as we should. We're not hearing about the Uyghurs in the far west, who are actually victims of genocide. You know, you talk about rape and forced abortion and organ transplantation and locking up millions of people in concentration camps. That's been going on in the far west of China for years. Most Americans still don't know about it. The same thing is happening to Tibetans. The only reason we know something about Shanghai is Shanghai is on the coast. It's one of China's largest cities. It's the major financial center. It's the most, quote-unquote, westernized city inside of China itself. And now it's being subject to a totalitarian nightmare.
Besides people throwing themselves off balconies, how are they protesting? Are people getting arrested? Is there any pushback this time around?
Well, people are taking to the streets in different neighborhoods. I mean, if you get hungry enough, you're going to break down the lock on your door. You're going to break down the barriers that the police have put up preventing you from going out in the streets and scavenging, literally scavenging for food on the shelves, the empty store shelves in the supermarket. And the reaction of the Chinese Communist Party has not been to say, maybe we pushed the people a little too far. The reaction of the Chinese Communist Party has been to bring in the People's Liberation Army, the guys with the big guns, because the guys with the little guns, the local police, can't handle the crowds anymore because they've grown too large. So now we're going to bring in the guys with the big guns and bring in the tanks and armored personnel carriers to keep the people down. And of course, they haven't just locked down Shanghai. They've locked down cities in the interior of China as well for a few COVID cases in their insane pursuit of COVID zero. But I argue that it's not, has nothing to do with public health. The COVID zero policy is an effort by the Chinese Communist Party to say to the Chinese people, we are in absolute control. Don't think that we can't dictate where you live, what you eat, when you eat, and whether or not you eat at all, because we are in absolute control. And the other thing that's going on here, wheels within wheels, is Shanghai is the center of resistance to the current Red Emperor Xi Jinping, who wants to be president for life. And there's a meeting coming up in the fall where the Communist Party Central Committee will vote on whether Xi Jinping is going to be president for life. And the people in Shanghai, the Shanghai leadership, don't want that. Well, guess what? The Shanghai leadership are now locked in their apartments along with everybody else. So a message is being sent to them as well.
In a different time in America, these cultural institutions that have so much global power, the media, Hollywood, would be documenting the daily travails of Brittany Griner being held in captivity, of Peng Shui being held in captivity and then forced to make essentially a statement of at the point of a gun that she's fine during the Olympics, would be documenting and doing movies about Jimmy Lai, who founded the Apple Daily publication before and has been in prison for the last year plus. Instead, we have Hollywood, as you were, and including Disney, as you were mentioning, editing their films to comply with Chinese communist censors. And this has been going on for a long time. I remember when the sequel to or the remake of Red Dawn came out, and it was supposed to be, the original conception was it was going to be Americans against the Chinese communists. That wasn't going to pass muster in the Chinese market, obviously. So they made it the North Koreans the bad guys instead. This has been going on for a long time, the abdication of moral authority by our media and by our cultural institutions vis-a-vis specifically China.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it has a lot to do with money. It has a lot to do with the corruption of the media, the abandonment of all principles, the abandonment of any sense that on the part of the American media that they are, in fact, American and have a right to defend the freedoms that they have prospered under. But China's gotten very, very clever, as Peter Schweitzer and others have pointed out, in something called elite capture. If you want to control the narrative, if you control what American foreign policy is towards China, then you begin co-opting future leaders. You go to the son of the vice president of the United States and you offer him sweetheart deals in China. And you simply give him literally tens of millions of dollars, knowing that part of that is going to go to the big guy. And when the big guy gets in higher office, he's going to pull his punches where China's concerned. Repeat that story again and again, dozens of times, not just on the federal level, but in some cases on the state level with different states where state officials have been compromised by the Chinese Communist Party as well. They've got basically three approaches. They're very simple-minded people, these Chinese Communist Party officials. They will offer you money, They will offer you drugs, and they will offer you sex. And if you fall for one or two or all three of those things, then you've fallen under their power, and you will not cross them because they've got the goods on you. They can blackmail you. They can control you. And I'm afraid that a lot of people in Washington, D.C. have been compromised in this way, including people at the very top of the U.S. government.
Yeah, but enough about Eric Swalwell. Something something else here, too. So cultural institutions, also financial elites. And the best example of this, where we are imposing self-inflicted wounds, is with the zeitgeist behind zero carbon emissions, zero COVID, zero carbon emissions, and this net zero asset owner alliance. You have some of the biggest pension fund holders, the biggest asset holders in the Western world, that controlling tens of billions of dollars in assets, pension funds like CalPERS, huge financial outfits, Novartis, for example, many, many others, Prudential, all signed on to be part of this net zero asset owner alliance. And this religious fervor behind moving away from sensible energy policy only serves to empower the Chinese communists.
Well, it does, because they're invested in China in a big way, and they turn a blind eye to the fact that China is building a coal-fired power plant, a new one every 2 weeks or so, because they have voracious energy needs, and they realize the only way to meet their energy needs and build the goods that they sell all around the world is by having access to cheap energy, and the cheapest energy is what you can dig out of the ground and burn in your coal-fired and gas-powered power plants. So that's what's going on in China. But does anyone talk about the fact that most of the plastic floating in the oceans is from China? Does anyone talk about the fact that most of the greenhouse gases, you're worried about that kind of thing, are being released into the air by China, and it's getting worse every year? China, the Chinese leadership, is happy to see us cripple our energy industry because that only makes them stronger vis-a-vis the United States. It only hastens the day when they will be the dominant power on the planet, which is their ultimate goal. I mean, look, this is a 100-year plan. It began in 1949 when the Chinese Communist Party took power, and the new Red Emperor Xi Jinping says openly and proudly that by 2049, which is not all that far away now, they're going to be the absolute dominant power on the planet. They're going to be the hegemon to which all other countries look for guidance and direction in how to govern their own people.
He is Stephen Mosier, president of the Population Research Institute, expert on China. He's also the author of Bully of Asia, Why Chinese Dream is the New Threat to World Order. Stephen Mosier, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
It's time for dramatic readings with Dan and Amy.
All right. This is Adam Kinzinger's Fare Thee Well op-ed from the Wall Street Journal. Going to be sampling some music here. This is not ready for Broadway yet. We're still working on it. So, you know, please be generous with your criticisms. And with that, Amy, please begin.
America is at a crossroads. Politically speaking, so am I.
The Republican Party I joined decades ago is unrecognizable today. It has favored conspiracy theories over truth, anger over hope, and division over problem solving. As I serve my final months in Congress, I find I'm left carrying the torch for the values and principles of a party that's been overtaken by partisan politicos looking for limelight and clinging to their sense of power instead of upholding their oaths of office. I'm holding out for hope. What I know the Republican Party has been and can be, but every day that passes, I'm feeling more politically homeless, and I'm not alone.
Shortly after the January 6th, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, I made a video calling out my party for having lost its way. Then I started the Country First organization for reasonable people of goodwill who want to bring truth and accountability back to government. In 1 year, it has grown nearly 150,000 members, including 6,000 volunteers, with chapters in all 50 states.
Americans across the political spectrum are tired of the vitriol and feel disenfranchised by both parties. Yet the outrage machine continues to churn out negativity. Bad actors are getting rich by peddling disinformation and fear, and the American people are paying the price. From wild conspiracy theories to carefully crafted misinformation, the public is more susceptible than ever to falling for these untruths.
With everything going on in Ukraine, we have to be clear-eyed about the gravity of this geopolitical movement, one of the most pivotal of our lifetimes. Some are using their platforms to provoke the latest outrage on Disney instead. It makes me sick to see people stoking this cultural anger and division for the sole purpose of ratings and money. Saying it's a disservice to the people who trust them would be a severe understatement. It's a dereliction of duty.
We are better than this. And to turn things around, we must demand better for our leaders, our media outlets, and ourselves. The Republican Party is led by a former president who admitted asking Vice President to overturn the 2020 election for him, and who seems to believe that the delusion he can be reinstated. These aren't the leaders we need, but the leaders we need are too afraid to stand up and speak out for the most part. Through Country First, I'm organizing a nationwide effort called Primary First, focused on voter education and engagement. I want to encourage Americans to show up for primary elections and vote for candidates who will be servant leaders to their constituents.
It shouldn't be a novel idea to tell the truth, to stand up for our democracy, and to serve with integrity, but it is. Now more than ever, we need to turn things around and put in the work to break free from toxic tribalism and extreme partisanship. My time in Congress may be coming to an end, but my fight for this country continues, politically homeless or otherwise.
And scene.
Cut. Paste.
All right. All right. Thank you very much. Well done. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. Will you be joining Country First, Adam Kinzinger's new No Labels organization, to fight for the right of every man and be a real American?
I mean, they have 150,000 members, and there's a chapter in all 50 states, he says.
So he says, yeah, so he says. I don't know, we got, you know, the 1812 Overture with that Twin Eagles suggestion we got from Frank and Arlington Heights earlier. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, again, it's sampling. I don't have the turntable I'm used to operating with at the ready, so we'll tighten that up. But, you know, you get the gist of it. I think it's powerful. And I think the musical accompaniment is something that Adam Kinzinger can use in more of his country first propaganda. The thing about Kinzinger here is it's all right. I'm truth and you're not. Basically, there's no like offer of proof for anything. Here are the principles. Here are the policies. This is what we're going to do. It's all just me vis-a-vis Trump. But he decries the cult of personality politics that he practices.
And that, you know, you're using your platforms to provoke latest outrage on Disney instead of focusing on Ukraine. And you know, we could do both. We can focus on foreign matters and domestic matters simultaneously.
That is
so
true.
Great that he's, you know, I'm going to pass this judgment on to you people.
That is true. It's a good point you raise because, you know, where is Adam Kinzinger, patriot? You know how I know that? Because he tells us all the time.
And he tells us about his service.
Where is he with respect to all of these cultural issues that have such great import in people's quality of life and the future of our country? You don't think the cultural issues, the quality of K through 12 education, or really pre-K through post-secondary education, is that an important matter as it pertains to the future of America? I think so. So, yes, we can support those people fighting for their homeland in Ukraine and also fight for our own homeland. But Kinzinger is AWOL when it comes to the fights on the home front, it seems to me. And I think that is instructive, isn't it? Oh, he'll say, well, I'm the 1-6 insurrection and the reckoning. Really? The 1-6 insurrection and the reckoning. Mm-hmm. That's his calling card, is it? Well, what about the 1-6 insurrection, as he terms it, and the reckoning. How is that going exactly? What we're finding out more and more undermines Kinzinger's position more and more, doesn't it? Seems to me. Miranda Devine had a good piece over the New York Post giving us a bit of a status update on that. And we find at least an assertion made by defense attorneys in one of the cases representing one of those people facing charges. As many as 20 FBI agents were embedded in the crowd on January 6th. So, okay, what were they doing? Is that a question that Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, the two Quislings, Pelosi Quislings, are intent on asking? Oh, as this Star Chamber committee proceeds, she notes here, the first acquittal of a Jan 6 defendant who was waved into the Capitol by cops as the latest sign the so-called armed insurrection is not living up to the Democrats' hype, or Kinzinger's. After the biggest probe in FBI history, no one, not one charge of insurrection has been brought against any Trump supporter at the Capitol. But that doesn't stop Adam Kinzinger from calling it an insurrection and repeating the talking points of the left, because he's a patriot and he's a no-labels guy and he's country first. Is that what country first looks like? Last week, the DOJ settled a lawsuit brought by civil rights activists over the violent riots outside the White House from May 29th to June 3rd. Don't remember Adam Kinzinger commenting on that. No. Those mostly peaceful protests, as the Washington Post describes them, were so violent Trump and his family had to be rushed to an underground bunker after the historic St. John Church was set ablaze. Has Adam Kinzinger weighed in on Antifa, Black Lives Matter? You know, he's a patriot, country first. Dozens of federal officers were injured when they were pelted with bricks, rocks, caustic liquids, frozen water bottles, Molotov cocktails, rental scooters, fireworks, and bottles of urine by rioters operating under the banner of Black Lives Matter. With respect to that insurrection, is that a proper term? Outside the White House that ran from May 29th to June 3rd of 2020, as those individuals represented in Washington laid siege to America's cities across the nation during that summer, you might recall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Never forget.
Last week's part settlement of four civil rights cases brought by the ACLU on behalf of BLM at D.C. and five protesters will cost taxpayers millions. But in a capitulation to the forces of destruction, it also strips park police and the Secret Service of tools to control future violent riots. Is that something that you're supportive of, Patriot Kinzinger? You want to reduce the police powers of the Park Police and the Secret Service as a settlement with BLM and the, dare I say, insurrectionists of that period in May, late May, early June? Very interesting what he chooses to focus upon and what he doesn't. Oh, by the way, there's also a lawsuit that's been filed by representative by somebody who's been charged with crimes associated with January 6th. Miranda Devine writes, Speaker Pelosi has been using the House Select Committee as an unconstitutional, unaccountable partisan star chamber whose sole aim is to dirty up Republicans ahead of the midterms. We know this. In July, she authorized the committee to investigate, quote, the terrorist mob attack. Is that a description that Adam Kinzinger would also embrace? Patriot, country first. The committee keeps releasing incendiary public statements about white supremacists. Pelosi's declared Trump an accessory to murder. Yet there's no prove up behind those assertions. And Adam Kinzinger is a church mouse when it comes to that, when he's not repeating the lines of Pelosi and the left. Any comment from Adam Kinzinger, patriot, country first, about the Whitmer kidnapping plot? A lawyer for Trump advisor Steve Bannon, who has been charged with contempt, filed a motion on Friday to dismiss Bannon's indictment for contempt, arguing that Pelosi's rejection of Republican members put forward by House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy renders the committee void. Wouldn't that be interesting if Pelosi's malice and the with only the support of a couple of perfidious House Republicans ends up destroying the committee that she's erected for these political purposes? Patriot.
Well, I wonder where the Patriot Adam Kinzinger was when, you know, Officer Brian Sicknick, the truth came out from him or about him that he suffered two strokes and died of natural causes.
People died on January 6th?
Yeah.
People died on January 6th. One of the pat lines of Pelosi and Kinzinger, Patriots, Country First.
And they still say that. The person that died was
Ashley Babbitt. Philip in his car.
Yeah, I wanted to make a point about Adam Kinzinger. So if we're to understand what he's saying, the Republican Party has left me, so I've decided to join in with the communists. That's basically what he's done. CNN and MSNBC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Philip. Yeah, that's about it. I know he's casting himself as, you know, there's vitriol on both sides, but it is worth noting, as we see from precursors to Adam Kinzinger, this is hardly a sui generis event, a Republican enthralled with his own perceived standing and the amplification he's been granted by the D.C. press corps for being a tool of theirs against the party that they oppose. No commentary in the direction of the left, except generically. A lot of commentary in the direction of Trump supporters specifically. Isn't that interesting? Joe Scarborough before him, Joe Walsh. You've seen this act before.
Mm-hmm.
It's no different when it's dressed up in a Air Force uniform, I'm sorry to say. And that's what Adam Kinzinger has done. Kevin in Austin, Texas.
I got serious. My first comment was going to be a joke, but I'll get serious in a second. Actually, I'm very excited I was able to watch it on Rumble because your dancing as you were narrating was excellent.
Yeah, thank
you. Amy throwing up the paper at the end was a dramatic flourish, which was just phenomenal.
Thank you very much.
That being said, Kinzinger is just, he's angling for corporate money to give speeches after he's out of office.
Okay.
He wants to make people who are upset with Biden feel good that, oh, you know, we can, this guy's he's a reasonable Republican, right? Let's go with this guy. It's just on the, you know, he's on the side of the corporatist and the globalist. And he's just angling for that. He's looking for money and speeches afterwards.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.